Welcome everyone to another session here with our podcast called the High Level Spotlight Sessions, where we bring in eight type players that are doing really cool things in the world of business. And today I have Tom Shipley. And if you don't know who Tom Shipley is, he's a serial entrepreneur, former special officer with the Israeli Defense Force, investor, strategic advisor, and one of the leading experts in what I call the omni-channel or omnipresent brand building and business aggregators. Tom's brands have sold over $2 billion through direct consumer marketing and retail through online, TV, radio, Amazon, Costco, Ulta, CVS, Nordstrom, like Home Shopping Networks, you name it. He's probably been there. Tom also raised well over $100 million from his PE and to launch a company called Foundry, which acquires and scales omni-digital brands. In addition, Tom is a strategic advisor to Snow Teeth Whitening with Josh. Josh is a great guy. I know him pretty well. And in 2022, Tom also launched his second roll-up platform, Ava, or Agency Ventures Aggregator. And Ava is leading the charge to acquire and scale 20 advertising agencies per year with really transformational people, first approach type of, you know, competing at a head-to-head level with traditional and global advertising styles. And it's really a holding company that he's putting together. So we asked Tom, and he's partnered up with us in the recent days. I've heard great things about him from our founders, as well as a lot of our VPs. So we decided, let's get on a quick podcast and talk about some of the things these agencies are facing. Before we get started, Tom, what's your story? Let's get started on a quick 1 or 2 minute intro. I knew I just read over a bio, but there's more to that than, you know, just, you know, a bunch of words. I want to know your full story of your world of business, and tell us.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm going to say is that as anyone who's listened to this as an entrepreneur is, I'm going to say that the core that holds us, that connects us together, is grit and heart. Starting businesses are tough. Some are might be easier than others. We might have moments in our life where we get lucky and the wind's in our back, but inevitably we're all going to hit our brick walls. And the question is do we have that resilience and tenacity? And yes, maybe my resilience was forged in the special forces, but I'm going to say it's part of how we're wired. Us entrepreneur, we have this innate nature to solve problems, to create something special and great. So I've always looked for opportunities. I look for what I call purple ocean opportunities. It's not the blue ocean where no one's there and no one's ever thought of and created before because there's no customers there. It's not the red ocean of commodities where everyone else is and it's shark and blood in the water. I look for purple ocean. Example of that is one of the most iconic brands that we built was Keranique. It's still in the category leader for women's hair loss. You'll find it in CVS, you'll find it in Ulta. But at one time it was the largest infomercial product online. It's digital is still the primary market for it. Amazon, it was a great brand that I sold off to private equity a few years ago. But again, it comes out with that spark, like we all have it, is what is that spark? What is that vision? And then how can you create that architecture of the plan that actually creates what most people would view as impossible to possible using points of leverage to scale it?
I love that. And
that brand did about $750 million over its lifetime, the first brand that we did. And just a quick pivot there, I think I told you a little bit before, is we started a brand called Hydroxytone in 2005 using omnichannel marketing to build an iconic beauty brand. We were struggling to grow it. We were out of cash. We went all in. We couldn't even afford to feed our families. We then identified a great business we were working with out of Hoboken, New Jersey, that was a $15 million, million and a half in EBITDA company that was doing supplements, but they had a whole platform versus us was two guys in an attic. We went, we were able to put together financing to buy this entity, and using this platform, we took Hydroxytone within 2 years to $100 million in sales. It's not about your resources. We never have enough. It's about resourcefulness.
I love that. So, you know, when we kind of prep for this podcast session, Tom and I talked a little bit to kind of prepare and figure out what's the right amount of information we want to share at the same time that's going to be valuable to all of you that are watching this. So the theme of this conversation is going to be how to grow to $125 million business via hyper acquisition. Some of the story that Tom is just sharing just now about how He acquired his first round of businesses and just really built brands that way. Now, in that topic, we're going to talk about three things. One is the misconceptions agency owners and marketers have in how they grow. Number two is how to actually prepare for an acquisition or a sale for that matter, so you don't blow this whole thing up. And number three is the playbooks, the SaaS versus marketing agency playbook that I've asked Tom to kind of just give us a little preview and idea on how he looks at things. So, Tom, give us a rundown of that story that you were just talking about. I know you shared a little bit of that with me. You guys were a really small business and essentially that grew through acquisitions. Help us understand that $125 million run, and then we'll go through these three pillars.
Okay, now, and again, I have built product brands, iconic decade durable product brands. And I've also in the agency world now where I'm acquiring advertising agencies and the services are on that. So I've been through the spectrum of what's out there. The challenge we had is when you start a business is you have limited resources. We didn't, there were two of us in an attic. We were outsourcing and contracting most things, but back then it was tough to even finding great contractors and reliable ones. And when you hire someone, what are you doing is it's costing you money out of pocket. And so we were bootstrapping. We went all in financially. We both mortgaged our houses. We even took loans out against our cars, whatever we could do to feed our family. So we were hitting a we basically capped out on our revenue and our cash flow on how we can build this $300,000 brand, but we had a vision on getting into 100 million. And then what we really needed is we needed cash flow, what we needed a platform to accelerate our growth. And that's when we were working with a company out of Hoboken, New Jersey. It was doing 15 million in revenue, 1.5 million EBITDA. The two founders had been in for 5 years. They were young. They had visions for what they could do with the next opportunity, next business. So we gave them what they thought was an irresistible offer. We thought it was a very conservative offer, but we gave it to them, which is the perfect situation. And I'll talk a little bit if you want to about narratives. Whenever you're buying a business, there has to be narratives that are parallel. You have a buying narrative, why you want to buy it. They have a narrative on why they want to sell. If a seller of a business doesn't want to sell, there is no narrative. There's just you're paying too much for that for them to say. But if you can find the narratives that intersect, there's might be opportunity for a great deal there.
Yeah, on
And
that note,
so
that's the first pillar, right? Which is the misconceptions of business owners and how they grow. And it starts with the narrative. So help us unpack that.
okay, it's a great question. Well, first of all, is the narrative for us was what was, and everything goes back to when the fundamental, there's some fundamental questions that I ask as an entrepreneur on a regular basis. And I challenge my team into it. The first one is, what's the problem? And you never ask what the problem is once. Once you ask the problem, what's the problem? You're typically getting to a symptoms. You say, what's the problem? Second time, you're getting to a symptom. You ask, what's the problem? Three, four, five, or 10 times, you're getting to the root cause of what the problem was. So we had to strip down of what was our problem because we were just all in, white knuckling it, significant stress about how to scale and grow based on the tools we had at hand. And we needed to change our narrative, change our story. Raising money for a company that is 300,000 in revenue, e-com, and your two former special forces guy were you doing a beauty brand? It was a tough way to raise money without that track record. And even though we had good metrics on our media, it wasn't good enough. The narrative when we threw in an acquisition, we're doing an acquisition, that's when it became very attractive for a large number of mezzanine lenders. And mezzanine lender are, it's not banks. Banks do not lend for this, okay? SBA will lend if you put a personal guarantee on it, okay? Mezzanine lenders typically have high interest in the 15 range, and they want a small piece of equity in your business to participate in the upside,
They
okay?
want a piece of the
Because
pie.
their overall annual return they're looking for is somewhere in the 20 to 25 with everything all said and done. And so by saying we're buying a positive business with $1.5 million in cash a year, we changed the narrative. And also we have hydroxytone, our core business, to put on top of it. That's why they lent us the money. It changed the narrative. So it's just not two guys in an attic. The other thing is we bought this whole suite of IT platform, accounting team, customer service, shipping. all together and 5 years of SOPs, we were able to basically buy with other people money, but therefore we didn't have to build the team and pay for it. It's changing your story, changing the narrative, and it's using leverage. Something, Paulson, that we talked about early is the highest and best leverage a CEO or founder can ever use and do is that of acquisitions. It is the highest, best use of times. I will say this though, if your business is growing at 40 or 50% per year, is and it's doing well and you're very profitable and your margins is 30, 40, 50%, is don't do acquisitions unless you really need to. Focus on your business, scale it, build your team, your infrastructure, build that incredible strong team with high trust behind you and keep on growing. But when you're starting to slow your revenue down to that 15% and between now and your exit horizon, you're not going to get there. That's when start focusing on actual acquisitions.
I love that. So, when it comes to misconceptions that a lot of agency owners, marketers, consultants, really authorities have in this space. First of all, what are some of those misconceptions most people deal with? Is it, do I, am I not profitable enough? Is it, do I have the right systems in place? And they get in the trenches, right? And they just lose the sight of what's outside of the world that they live in as far as business is concerned. What are some things that you've observed from agency owners specifically in misconceptions of how they grow?
The number one limitation for every single business, wherever it is, whenever they peek out with everything new, is in their head. There are things that were there that, it's our frontal cortex that's protecting us, our dinosaur brain. We're going through our protective loops, and therefore it's restricting us to be creative, to open up. And it's always, we can't do things. So let me just teach you a secret that I learned 3 years ago. It was out of a Harvard professor. And where I was just, again, I'm a guy who's strategic and like to think big, but on the other hand, is I'm a classically trained industrial engineer who thinks of the practical reasons why things can't get done and what you need to do in order to build that architecture to get there. And instead of thinking about why can't, the question that I learned was, what would have to be true to make this possible? What would have to be true to make this possible? I'm going to answer your question in a quick second, but a quick segue is, it was during COVID. It was, we thought the world was coming to an end for our business at that period of time. It turned out to be go time for e-com businesses and brands, but we thought it would be dark. I was talking with a friend of mine in Austin. He owns a great Amazon agency. I said, let's do something fun. Let's buy an Amazon e-com business. And then I asked, said, Brian, instead of buying one, why don't we buy several? A couple of days later passed. Brian, instead of buying several, why don't we buy two a month? And then I said, well, I know why you don't do that, because your business is going to blow up. It's impossible. We can't do that. And then I learned that question, what would have to be true to make it possible? So I changed my operating assumptions. I looked at everything that would have to be true. I said, I can do that. I can do that. I can do that. I can do that. I went, we put together a quick team. I met with six private equity, seven private equity firms, got term sheets between $50 to $100 million because I couldn't afford to scale like that. And pick two of the best that we love together. And that's how we started Foundry Brands. What would have to be true to make it possible? So the first limitation's in our head. The second thing is resourcefulness over resources. You do not need capital to acquisitions. I can meet with any agency that has revenue, and I can give you access within 5 days to 1 to 2 months of revenue. So if you negotiate, the third, the next thing, part of that is, you're not buying a business for all cash. There are different terms. There's part cash at close. There's monthly payments. There's stock. There's ways to structure it if you are creative on how to do this. So again, it's about being resourceful and having access. The next powerful thing is I don't need to know the how. I need to know the who. I don't need to know how to do acquisitions. I need to find the right people to give me guidance, to give me the playbook. I don't need to know the financial structures in order to make this possible. I need to find the who that can give me guidance. And then, as I understand the narrative of the seller and I get to know them, the other thing is if you're doing acquisitions correctly, that once in a lifetime opportunity of the perfect deal in the perfect structure that should come across your life once in a lifetime should happen several times a year by knowing a little bit of insight how to create that lead flow and how to have conversations. And if once you learn how to have the conversation, you're open to it. By saying, asking people is, have you ever thought about selling? When do you think you'll be exiting your business? What does that look like? And suddenly you're entering these discussions and finding the how to do this from structures to doing due diligence. And there are companies out there that can help you do this that are set up for that. So
Yeah.
those are the core fundamentals that I see as far as getting in people's way.
Yeah. And then when it comes to misconceptions, maybe we can parlay into this a little bit. Can you talk about what you said about leverage? You said leverage, and you kind of braced over it really quickly, but can you elaborate off what you mean by leverage? Is it people leverage, resources, systems? Like, what are some things there and some misconceptions around leverage people may have?
It's a great point. So in special forces, we learned about force multipliers. There are certain things that give us the tactical advantage, and even GPS in the battlefield. If you have GPS and the other side doesn't, you have a tactical advantage again. So if you think about that, same thing in business. We all have our resource, our network. Our network is a great source of leverage in our contacts, and we should, as founders and CEOs, we should be always investing every day into expanding our network and our visibility in social media, because that gives us unfair leverage on deals that will come your ways and people's levels of trust in you. Also, whether it's your network, also knowledge is a point of leverage. And I view that when I talked about leverage is doing acquisitions. And if you once you learn a little bit on the playbook of acquisitions, and I'm going to say that this is your first one is tough, but the first time you do everything's tough.
Yeah.
But it's not impossible. It's like when everything we do that. So what I tell most people is just go for it, and you're going to learn, and the person that you are on the other side is going to be different. As we know, the person who started any of your businesses and any of my business, that version of Tom Shipley was not the same guy who was there a year or two later. The guy who started the vision is, I want to create a $100 million business, was incapable. I didn't have the capacity, the knowledge, the mindset to build a business that did $100 million a year. Because the most I ever done is getting to $1 million a year, was like impossible with my first business. And then I said, oh my God, let me do a $10 million a year business. Oh my God. And then once I got there, then I put another zero. Can I share something also with your people? Is that what I challenge you to do is take your business and add a zero to it. And then ask the question is, what would have to be true to make that possible? Then for fun, add another zero and say, what would have to be true to make that possible? I'm not saying to do it, to go for that, but it's an exercise and really powerful to change your paradigm. And you might find something, it's going to force you to think differently than the same, I'm going to say, rule book you're following right now. Because when you think about it, is at the 30 years from now, looking back, or 40 years looking back, you say, look at the legacy of my life. What do I regret? You're going to regret the things that you didn't go for. You're going to regret not putting a zero onto it. You're going to regret time with family. You're going to regret adventures. You're going to regret that you didn't have a bigger impact in people's lives. But those things that you thought were impossible, that you went, wow, years later, I learned they were possible. What was holding me back? And therefore, is start with just creating a vision and adding a zero to your business, then add another zero and say, what would be true? The point of leverage, when I was talking about with agency, is by doing an act or acquisitions, whether you have a SaaS business or an agency or an e-com business or any, even a lawn care business, it really doesn't matter. By doing acquisitions and then you build a playbook, and it's just you take complex and make it boring, you are suddenly taking your profit, your EBITDA, and then you're doubling it, and you're doubling, you're doubling it, and you're building better teams. You can afford the higher quality people. You're letting go of not only your poor performers, but your mediocre performers, and your C and B minus performers will kill your company. And you're constantly leveling up to a high level. You like that high level I threw in there?
Like that.
So.
You know what? One of the most important points that you made is applicable to anybody that's watching this, which is the person that's running the $100,000 a year business versus the $1 million a year business versus the 10 versus 100 to a billion or even 10 billion. Those are five, six, seven different types of people with different characters, even though they all have the same names. Which is you that's watching, by the way. We're talking about you that's watching and the mental paradigm shift that you have to make. The $1 million business owner is drastically different than the $10 million business owner and the $1 billion business owner. And the reality is the business environment has not changed. The rules of the games have not changed. The possibilities, resources have not changed. The only thing that changed is the player in the game, and that's the growth of the player. So what are some things people can do in the acquisitions journey to grow as they're in it? Because I think that's a big misconception as we just kind of close out this first pillar of misconceptions around acquisitions. It's like, how do I grow as a person and still level up fast enough so when I acquire a business, I'm ready for it? I just sometimes people just feel like they're not ready for it because they feel like they need to grow fast, you know?
You're 100% correct. I'm going to say that your business, as you're doing your acquisitions, making sure your team is in place and you're focused on your SOPs, but leverage outside learning opportunities on how to do acquisitions. And just an example, and I'll just do an invitation, is I realized that we could not have a big enough impact on the ecosystems by just doing this. Doing what we call a founder-friendly and a team-friendly way of doing acquisitions when we buy businesses. The only way we can change the ecosystem is by actually teaching our playbook. So I don't know of any other roll-up, any holding company in the world, not 198 of the top 200 advertising agents in the world are all holding companies. I don't know of anyone that's teaching their playbook, their secrets of all these years. And we're saying the opposite is that we want everyone to know our playbook. I don't want, because it the amount of money I've spent millions of dollars on attorneys, and I've learned who are the best attorneys, and I have insights there. And I have insights on deal structure, and I've worked with probably a dozen different investment bankers. And so I learned so much the hard way. My partner, Peter Lang, has built, tried to take the complexity of acquisitions and turned it into programmatic mergers and acquisitions, which is the fancy way of saying we're putting into really straightforward SOPs that you can delegate to outside team. Okay, I'm making sure no one's listening, but do you know who does our lead gen for our acquisitions? We have a person in Serbia who every day is sending out LinkedIn invitation. We create scripts, and every day is boring. And they on that there's a link they can set up a call. And it goes to a person in our team who's the front line who does the first interview. You don't have to hire an investment bank to in order to do your lead flow for this, okay? So
Yeah, especially if
just
you're a marketing agency, you should know how to do lead generation.
yeah. And it's just as simple as that is, but again, it's perception. It's like something new. Oh my God, how do I do this? Is you take so what we do is we're teaching this. So in February 11th through the 13th, we're putting together 100, I'm going to say, CEOs with a real growth mentality and openness to scale. And we're inviting, and the agency owners typically have revenue between 1 million and 20 million. And we're inviting them to join us in Nashville for Scale at Speed Live.
Yeah, and
So,
we'll
and
talk a
they.
little further about that event towards the end of the podcast as well for those of you that may want
Perfect.
details. I know High Level is partnered up with it. I know some of our guys and gals are going to be there sponsoring as well. So let's back to the conversation, which is growing to $100 million plus business with hyper acquisitions, right? So we talked about the first pillar, which is around a lot of the misconceptions about acquisitions. The second thing I want to talk about is the phase of preparation, Tom. What are some things the buyers should have prepared versus the sellers should have prepared? Like both sides require a lot of preparation, but what does that look like?
Okay, it's a perfect thing. It's a perfect thing that you brought up. From a buyer's perspective, is you should have your M&A team identified in your process, just down on what you're going to do. And remember, you don't have to have the whole thing fleshed out. You just need to know the next steps that you need to do and have that fleshed out. And so, and when I say your M&A team isn't necessarily your internal team, because typically most agencies and most companies and e-com and SaaS companies don't have an M&A team. But they identify who can support you from an external perspective, doing the different processes that need to be done for everything from sourcing to due diligence. But having a playbook so you know that, okay, We're going to go and we're going to identify the different agencies, and here's the information we need to find out in our preliminary due diligence. Preliminary due diligence just means it's the basic information you need to know to say, yes, this looks good. And if when we do our confirmatory due diligence, everything lines up, we're going to buy this company, and also get the information you need in order to put together an offer. When we do our preliminary due diligence, one of the phases, we actually have a very long survey that can take 48 hours for the 4 to 8 hours for the owner to fill out. But we learn everything about them. We learn what their goals are. We learn about their family. We learn about what they think about their team. We learn their metrics. Because our goal is to identify, remember I said what their narrative is understand their narrative, and then find a solution in a deal structure, which might be completely different than you expect. The other thing to remember when you're doing a deal structure is what the other person is thinking is 99% of the time different the way you're thinking about it. You might have your deal and the way you structure it, it might be completely different. I've seen deals where owners get, and I'll talk about this in a second from valuation because I think your listeners might be interested in this, where some owners get 10 times the multiple of their annual revenue, which means the company is buying it and saying, I predict that this company's revenue is going to profit is going to last for 10 years like this, or I'm going to capture this within a shorter period of time plus, and have confidence in that. Or, and I've seen higher than 50 or 70% cash for those. I've seen, especially in the SaaS business, 80, 90% cash with a little bit on the earnout. So again, that's just, but because you say this is what my number is, doesn't mean that they're thinking about it. But you might have a different agenda. We met a agency owner, he's in his 70s. His wife said, you have, and this business generates cash. It's been going on for years. His wife said, you have 12 months to either sell it or close it down. He has all these employees that he's known for years. He wants to take care of them. So his agenda is different. And I'll share this with you. 80% of businesses that go on the market, actually, I've always known it was 80%. Yesterday, I heard the number. It was only 1 in 11 that go on the market, even with investment bankers, even with term sheets, never close. So most processes are broken, and therefore, most businesses will end up thinking they're going to sell, will just close down. Now, so that means there's a lot of flexible deal structures that are out there for you as an agency owner, which means very little cash and could be payments along the way that the business you're buying is cash flowing in. And by the way, if you're a SaaS business, I know lenders that will basically give you the money to pay the lender to do because you're buying a good, consistent cash flowing business. And there are lenders that love to lend to SaaS businesses that will help you buy other businesses. And you can service the debt and have cash and bring in infrastructure, have another product to cross-sell your customers. So there's a lot of advantages to that. But just because understand that your narrative isn't the narrative. Now, if you want me to talk briefly about multiples and what sale multiples are.
Before we go into the multiples, let's make sure we elaborate on a couple of items here. So
Okay.
preparing as the buyer versus preparing as the seller. Yes, 1000%. There are two different narratives, two different expectations, intentions, a lot of different moving pieces between team members, systems, SOPs. What does the next chapter look like? All those things have to be flushed out. And there's quite a bit there. Now, Tom, if you can take like 2 minutes and qualify a good purchase as a buyer. Let's say we're listening to you, we're listening to the podcast of, okay, Paulson saying, let's go acquire some agencies. What are some things you're looking for as the buyer? Because the conversation here is very, very much the recommendation to go buy businesses, right? So what are the things that you're looking for as the buyer, and what are the advantages you want to have as the buyer? Like, what are the cards? What are my double ace cards that I would want to have when I look at a deal?
100%. So first of all, I start with revenue and EBITDA. Just real high level is, and it gives me a feeling of the range, the trade. The next thing is, what is the niche? And the other thing is, does this fit my current business? If let's say I have a business, my first, the first agency we bought is a business to government or complex business to business agency. It would be bad fit for me to buy a consumer lead gen performance marketing agency and slap them two together. One is The cultures are completely different. The models, there's nothing synergistic there. So I need to be very thoughtful in making sure that the business makes sense, that there is some, I hate the word synergy, but there's some complementary things we can do from business development, back end, other things that make sense for us putting together. The number one thing we look at right after that is cultural fit. We spend a lot of time with the owners and the team seeing cultural alignment. You put someone, a steady state business, very open, warm environment with a hustle, hard nose, and agency, you're going to find conflicts. And what happens so, and or you put a fast paced entrepreneur environment with a bureaucratic agency or a bureaucratic business, you're going to see not only first, you're going to see when you
Don't
put them
push.
together, you'll see if founders will leave. 80% of founders leave and never stay for the earn-out from acquisitions because of cultural fit. 80% never get the earn-out for that reason. They're for cultural fit. When they leave, a lot of the key employees leave. When they leave, some of the businesses leave, some of the clients leave. So again, so cultural fit is the next thing. Then we look for discount factors. Some things we look at discount factors to minimize our risk is client concentration. If 70% of their business is from one client and the client leaves, it's an issue. We looked at the longevity of the clients. Let's say they have nice diversification, but most of their clients turn over every 3 to 4 months. So they're on a hamster wheel. We look at that. Okay. So the client is a
Determine.
project versus contract, recurring revenue. That's why I love SaaS businesses. So those are things we look at. How good are they at lead gen? How much role does the owner have in lead gen as well as delivery? If the owner's doing either most of delivery or most of lead gen and the owner leaves, what happens to the client base of that business? Again, what we look for when I'm buying businesses, and I share this with you, and we buy a business and we say we're buying you for 2 times, 3 times, or 5 times your annual cash flow, which is EBITDA or SDE, taking SDE, doesn't really matter, seller discretionary earnings, okay? When we look at that, and I'm saying, okay, we'll give you 5 times. I need to have confidence I'm going to get at least that 5 times plus my return on capital, and then have the ability upside. All these things about discount factors is all about identifying the risk. Do you have like one employee and everyone else is freelance contractors throughout the world? Then that creates a higher risk. So those are some of the things that we look at when we look at what the discount factors are, which tell us either it's a no-go or we're going to reduce the price and the deal structure to match the risk.
Another thing I think I assume you will look at is the market concentration. So like how much of the business is inside the dental world versus plastic surgery versus internal medicine versus even subsectors of an industry. Like same thing with like real estate, a really popular one that has hundreds and hundreds of sub industries within it. And then I also assume you also look at third party involvement. How much of the work is being contracted out? Who are the third parties that are involved, and how do they create risk? And I'm putting my MBA in finance slash risk assessment hat on as we talk through this. But do you agree to that, or do you know are those things that you look for as well?
The answer is of course, of course. And again, there's certain verticals that we love and we see that are growing, others that are getting more competitive. We look at the competitive landscapes, the people that are coming in, and certain ones that are hot. Dental is a very competitive one, but it's so big and so hot right now that it's a great niche, very hot. And so there's significant growth. We also look at the fact of AI risk. How vulnerable are they? Basically, anti-fragile when it comes to AI, or are they having a high risk of getting displaced, where people are basically going to the margins in their area are going down to by 90% over the next 2 years? So we look at that also and saying, because every business is going to be more efficient and more profitable if the culture and the team is focused correctly by leveraging AI. We all know that. However, certain businesses are going to be put at risk from that perspective also.
From a
Low,
simple
low end,
term.
if I'm a low-end logo firm, I'm a creative firm and we do great, and if we charge very minimal prices and we do a high volume and it's all by hand, you don't really have a business. If I'm still that upper tier prestige and I charge $500,000 for a logo because the big companies use me, okay, AI is going to help you and not put you out of business.
Exactly. And I was going to just say, give us an example, because what I knew what you're thinking is like a lot of the creators struggle with that whole AI thing because a lot of it is getting replaced. Same thing with written content, blogging, even video
Oh, yes.
editing is getting destroyed with AI because now you can just throw in a 3-hour video and get 130-second snippets in 5 minutes. I mean, so the editing world is probably now going to have to be pretty competitive, right? So, before we get off of that topic of how to prepare as a buyer and a seller, and we're also talking in the lane of things to look for as you buy and kind of figure out what the advantage cards are. What are the multiples that you like as a buyer? If I'm going to go out there buy an agency like you're recommending, I don't want to be paying more than what I need to, but what are ranges that you can expect, and what's conservative, what's liberal, hyper versus not so hyper. Like, help us understand that.
I will share this with you is my price, your terms, your price, my terms. I'll come back to that in the minute, okay? After I talk, let me talk about multiple and create a foundation. But my price, your terms, your price, my terms, and I'll tell you why. Well, let's start with foundation is whenever we look at businesses, we start from their EBITDA perspective before we look at discount factors, as I talked about. And so an agency that's generating somewhere about $500,000 in EBITDA a month, we look at it and say, okay, in the range, I'm looking at probably 2 to 3 times multiple of their annual profits and the annual cash flow. If they're in the million range, is probably going into the 3, 3.5. If we're talking 2, it might be at 4. If they're talking 3 to 5, it might be at 5. Now, what changes that? If suddenly I'm looking at business and they have a 5% margin on their business, 5% profitability, that means they can go tomorrow negative. Is that EBIT is not worth much because it adds too much risk to the business. So we look at all the discount factors that we had talked about earlier to say, and that will either drive it higher or lower. Now, the way to fix a lot of issues is deal structure can help address risk. For example, someone says, I want a 10X. I'm doing $1 million in my agency. And it's a standard creative shop that they want 10X on it. And they want, therefore, $10 million. I might say to them, I'll give you $10 million if I pay you $1,000 a week forever.
Yeah, so your price, my terms.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And that's an exaggeration.
Of course.
But sometimes you can cure a lot of discrepancies. And so we bought an agency where we did somewhere about 7.5% cash at close and monthly payments. And therefore, we went up in our price by about 20% that we would pay for that. We were fine. They're good because they get the monthly check that comes in. They have confidence. They know what we're going to do with it. There's cultural alignment. It's a great home for their team. So therefore, they're comfortable with it. So that's it. It all depends. And our narrative fit her narrative, and we found a price that worked for both of us. So it
Yes.
was her price, our terms.
I love that. And the multiples that you look for an agency versus SaaS, because the next pillar that I really want to talk about is the playbook between both of those. But can we talk about the multiple on both of those? I know you said you like SaaS a lot.
So I'll share this with you is everything is about niche and what someone's expertise and the confidence in the recurring revenue. So when we're talking about, and I'll give you an example, I think at the very beginning, I might have mentioned that a friend of mine just sold his agency and he got a 10X on his agency. But why is he has consistent 30 to 40% growth per year. He's been around for 8 years. His team is outstanding as seller. His SOPs are strong. In his niche on what he does, there is no one better than what they do, and he's in a growing market. So when another strategic agency looked at him, they said he is N equals one of the mark of the universe out there of everyone else that does it. We will pay a premium because we know with our 300 clients, they'll all use this, and therefore we get a big return on investment. Okay, so that is
Makes a
how
big
you get a
difference.
higher multiples. Okay,
Yeah.
now SaaS agency is the predictability of the future income and the consistency and the lacking customers. You can look at the when I'm looking at a SaaS business, and I'm not a SaaS expert, let me throw it out there. But if I look at it, I'd be looking at cost to acquire customers, lifetime value of the customer, stick rate, attrition rate, and look at the core business on itself and saying, based on this, my level, and then the risk that this platform is going to go away from competition or changes in technology. Again, I look at that and then say, well, based on that, I'm willing to pay 10 times, 15 times, or 20 times, especially if I know that I can put into my platform and I know my customers will leverage this and I can just expand, or I'm growing my market share. And by owning more of the market, I know that I'm increasing my multiple. What we didn't talk about is, what we did talk about briefly is, if you're at a $500,000 EBITDA in the agency world, you might be trading at a 2x EBITDA. If you do an acquisition, several acquisitions, and now you're at a, you went from 500,000 to 1 million, another acquisition, 1.5 million, another acquisition, now you're at $2 million. So not only do you have all this extra EBITDA, that basically a cash flow, and it is now suddenly your business went from being worth 2x 500,000, $1 million, now as your business is worth 4x $2 million, your business is worth $8 million. You can't, it's tough to get there, and it's risky to get through organic growth like that. This is the power of acquisitions.
Yeah, and it's interesting because you hear people talking about this, but there's not a lot of doers that go down the lane of acquisitions and mergers. And I think it's because of confidence. I think it's the entrepreneurs that can handle the stress that comes with it. It's just a whole lot less. I don't know if you're a big fan of guys like Dan Pena, or even like Cody Sanchez, who does the contrarian thinking, or even like folks in that world, the sharks as well, like the on ABC and NBC, right? Like the world of entrepreneurship becomes, I think, a whole lot more fun when you go down the lane of not having to grow the business organically, but acquire things that are already grown, right? It's a whole different game that you play. Help us understand what that feels like, what that looks like. Does that shift your thinking? And that will be the last thing we really kind of go through on preparing as a buyer.
Yeah, and I know we miss preparing as a seller, but from this perspective is, and the road I went through down is, I've always done acquisitions. I was the accidental acquirer. Someone brought me an opportunity, I looked, and then it solved a problem that I was having. I went, wow, that was great, but then I wasn't, I'll wait for the next one to come. And it was a friend of mine, Roland Fraser, who helped me change my paradigm and say, oh, okay, we're going to create these opportunities, and therefore I'm going to build my own playbook, and therefore I'm just going to build my SOPs around it the way I built my SOPs in my business, and make the complex boring, and make this just the way I do business and the way I grow in every business I'm in now. Most of my, I shared that I did $2 billion in revenue for my brands that I built. Almost every one of those was built from scratch. However, if I would have known then what I know now is, I would have bought a small brand that got to a certain level, 1, 2, 3 million in revenue, and therefore knowing my playbook on how to scale versus all the energy and years I spent in investing into brands that were small, that really never made it that hard, that high. Because once they're at the velocity of certain sizes, if you know the key leverage, and I can go into any business and increase their EBITDA, their profit by 35%. I can go to almost any business and do that. There's just three basic changes I make to do that. So acquiring a business, I apply those three fundamentals, and boom, suddenly I made the ROI on that.
Yeah, and I think this is beautiful. This is a beautiful part about business to me, because I started off in entrepreneurship, I want to say like 2013, where I started going all in on it, and I built my first agency in the dental space from scratch.
Oh,
Took
did you really?
yeah, I, and then I built a second agency in automotive, and then the third agency was the white label agency behind High Level with Rob and Alex, which we almost scaled to almost 800 plus people. We did, I mean, clients. And I'm telling you, as much knowledge and how much grace we had doing that, it was so difficult. And what I know now is to go right into just getting the funding, getting the means, going and buying a stable micro agency that I know I can use as a house and then build on top of it through acquisitions and mergers. So for you to just kind of lay this out, you kind of described my own personal last 8 years of journey, which I think the big difference is the person that I was in 2013 jumping into entrepreneurship versus who I'm today. It was obviously drastically two different human beings. And that's what every entrepreneurs should like really strive for is leveling themselves up to a certain level so they can handle the stress and the fun and the excitement and the adrenaline that comes with the next level. Can you speak on that a little bit of the different phases you went through to get to the point where you're like, you know what? Your confidence is probably off the roof now to just probably go buy multi-billion dollar businesses. There's no point in doing $100 million businesses anymore, right?
I like, let me put it this way, is I'm actually buying businesses and doing putting together, it's basically making complex, make it boring. We're buying businesses between 1 to 3 million in EBITDA. And
Right.
occasionally we'll buy something half if we believe it's strong enough to do that. Because at a certain level, they're steady, they're growing, they're profitable, and we can buy them at the right multiple and then see how, and we have the playbook to grow it. It's easy to grow a business that's doing five, it's easier for me to double a $5 million business than it is to double a $50 million business. So again, so those are also, and also from, if you think about portfolio by diversifying it, I'm minimizing my risk from that perspective. But yes, there is the fundamentals of business, as you know, Paulson, as you learn building your agencies, is it starts with understanding the power of people. I learned this in Special Forces that with the right people around you that you trust, it's all about trust. And so with a high level of trust, and it's capable, if you have weak members of the team, it's going to pull down the team, they lower your average. If you have all high performers and there's high level of trust in integrity as well as capability, there's almost nothing you do. It raises your level of confidence. You're then able to delegate and get out of the way. You remove yourself from the bottleneck, and then you all build your business based on SOPs and standard operating procedures. So therefore, that they're a great team then can delegate down and offshore, outsource. It makes no difference. It's how we at Atlantic Coast Brands went from 550 employees to the same size company with 23 employees. Great people, leveling them up, SOPs, technology, and then outsourcing. And again, therefore, you it's and when you get to we had a lot more fun at 23 employees and 100 million in revenue than we did at 550 employees. With again, we were in the HR business. So again, but we evolved along the way from a growth perspective in team, SOPs, structures, and then mentally getting out, it's only zeros, and that the only thing that's blocking it. And the bigger you are and the bigger you buy, the easier it is because you're taking less risks because they're already steady, they're growing. If you buy something very small and one person leaves, it's a lot of risk, or you're going in there and you're doing everything yourself. And the only thing difference between you buying a $1 million SaaS or agency, or remember, you could get funding for either. Let me change that. It's easier to get money for a larger SaaS platform, or it's easier to get outside money loaned to you for a larger agency than is a small one. So I'll just share that with you. So
Just
it's
the
just in
risk
your
that,
head.
yeah, and what you described is, the story of, it's so much easier to move the canoe in the water versus a cruise liner. As you get bigger, one decision affects 800 people and their whereabouts and how they do things, and change doesn't happen that quickly. The change agent could be fantastic, it doesn't matter, but the effect of change will not really trickle in for months and weeks, especially the bigger you are, versus you got two people, you teach them two things, let's get moving next week, we're on to the races, right? So it's really important to understand from a preparation standpoint as an acquisition person going into this conversation to look at where that business is internally and how they operate. I think that's really what it comes down to, is understanding the culture and how they operate. Because if you can't figure out that formula, the books look good, the market looks good. I mean, all the deals are going to look good anyway. But the problem is, who is running the deal? What exactly are they doing? You want to add any thoughts to that?
Yeah, to me, it's SaaS business are a little bit different because sometimes you're just buying a technology platform and nothing else, not a team, and therefore it's easier to do. But we're talking about agencies are people businesses. Most businesses are people business, and therefore culture is everything. You go in and you want to change the culture because to match yours, you are suddenly bought something of a perfect engine that's running perfectly, and you're throwing a wrench into a Ferrari. You don't know what's going to happen. Okay, so the same thing here is that you want to make sure you're buying something that is culturally aligned with you and your values and your ethics, and also matches with the companies you're buying. And like I said, the trust and that culture is so after we look at the first thing, before we go into a lot of discount factors, we look at the culture, and if it passes our culture fist after our initial, we'll never go into confirmatory due diligence or even offering a term sheet if there's not cultural alignment, which is why we've talked to 1,000 agency owners that want to sell over the last 18 months.
Amazing. So let's talk about the third pillar, which is SaaS versus marketing agency, the playbook. And what I'm thinking about the playbook is what you do after you acquire to stabilize it. What you do after you acquire to really stabilize the business to the point where you wanted to, how to grow it. I think I lost you for a quick second, but you're back. But help us understand SaaS versus marketing agency, the playbooks that you run after acquisition.
Yeah. So during the confirmatory and due diligence process, we start putting together the acquisition and the onboarding plan, and then how it's going to be running. And the onboarding can take anywhere from 90 days to 6 months. But we have every month what's going to happen starting at day one, including day one is the introduction to us and their team. And again, what we're doing is everyone hates change, so their employees are at flight risk once they hear there's an acquisition. So we have everything down as far as what happens from that perspective in order to minimize risk of this very valuable asset that we just bought. So understanding what your playbook is from what you're going to do once you take over in day one is extremely critical, with the idea of my rule number one is do no harm. The other thing I'll let me share with you is we have two playbooks. Our primary playbook for acquisitions is we buy healthy companies and we don't integrate them. We buy them because they're healthy and they grow and have great culture and they're a fit within a group. And basically, we then give them, re we take over their back-end accounting, finance, HR stuff they hate, but we let them do what they do. We sit with them and we say, what is your 3-year plan? We help them as facilitators, them drawing out their detailed quarter by quarter 3-year plan. And then we ask them, what support do you need? Because I don't care whether they get an outside contractor or consultant to do it, whether they learn themselves or leverage us and our playbooks. The minute I go to them and say, this is the way you'll do that, I own their problems and I own their results. So, and basically, we're buying these entrepreneur organizations. So let's give them the resources they never had and let them grow. The other playbook, we have agencies that come to us that want to be part of one of our agencies. And then from there, we'll have a lot tighter integration. But even with that, we don't integrate in day one. We typically slow roll that. It could be 3 months to 6 months to a full integration there. Because again, our goal is to do no harm.
I love that. I think from a risk management standpoint, there are the conservative styles and there's the liberal styles, you know, like the Elon Musk style of just coming in and, you know, ripping up house. And for some
Later.
certain sectors that works, right? And others obviously don't. But what are the styles that you really like? Do you, and it seems like you're a bit more conservative on your style and just making sure things are stable, but I think you acquire businesses that don't have to be touched too much.
That's correct. That's correct. My expression is I do not buy falling knives. I do not buy falling knives. And falling knives, and again, because you can get cut, you might cash in the right place, but it's really risky. And even though it's a deal you can, if I've ever been burned on acquisitions because it was a deal so good, even though it was a distressed asset, I couldn't pass up. The amount of energy and effort we put to turn it around in hindsight was never worthwhile for those that we successfully turn around. There are so many great, healthy, growing businesses that don't require that. I rather index to that and giving them, it's like keeping, you have a ball spinning. I rather just be that little bit and versus spin it versus the guy who's trying to get it to spin without falling off. Most time they fall off.
I love that. So Tom, I know there's so many hours we can talk about this conversation. This is your big wheelhouse and a lot of the things that I've learned over the years as well, and great examples that you shared about how to really grow with acquisitions. I loved it. Can you share a little bit about your event? I know we briefly talked about it as we kind of closed out the podcast, but I know we're coming out there with our team, I believe, in February in Nashville. Is that right?
February 11th to the 13th in Nashville. If anyone's information, it's at scaleatspeedlive.com. And let me put it this way, there's 2 days we're going to teach you about our playbook for acquisition. Our attorney, who it took me years to find someone as good as Robin Sears, that she's the best that I know. We're having people coming in, we're talking about deal structure. We're going to teach you all the fundamentals that you need for acquisitions. The most important thing it will do, it will change the way you think about growth and growing your agencies. If you're thinking about selling your business, you're going to learn what you need to know when you're ready to exit, whether it's in 2024 or 4 years from now. Again, you want to know what the other side is so you can prepare your business for sale for maximum exit. And the people in the room might be the people that might buy your business. So it's 100 CEOs on fire that are coming. They're doing between $1 million-$20 million in revenue, February 11th through the 14th. Our goal is to over-index in giving. And if everyone who leaves doesn't come and saying, "Oh my God, I learned this, this, and this," and change their paradigm and have valuable tools, then we failed. And I don't lose. And the other thing is the day, third day is our AI day. And basically we're having Perry Belcher, who's one of the smartest marketers, serial entrepreneurs I
Yeah,
know,
we
and
had him
he's a
over at
good
our
friend.
conference as one of our keynotes. We love Perry.
So Perry, him, so he's on fire. He'll be spending our AI day. We have a couple of speakers coming in for our AI day. And then basically is how he's actually pulling back the curtain on how he was able to leverage AI over the last 3 years to scale his agency. So I said, "That's what we're going to do." We have other people coming in that will be speaking about the same thing. So I hope some of your members, some of your users can join us, because I'm always looking for people, entrepreneurs that are on fire, that I can help, that we can partner with in the future. So I hope that some of those gems that are out there, because
Yeah,
I know you have
absolutely.
2 million user there, will join us.
Absolutely. And we're going to be sponsoring that event for you as well. So we're excited for it. But anyways, Tom, it was a great session. I appreciate you jumping on such a quick notice. I'm looking forward to working with you in the future. And those of you that are watching, in case out there, if you don't have a high-level account, jump into one of our 14-day trials that are probably in one of the links or somewhere around here below in the YouTube channel or wherever. But hopefully you got a lot of nuggets out of this. This is our high-level podcast called the Spotlight Sessions, where we bring in top players across the industry. So Tom, thank you for jumping in. Any final words that you want to share to the entrepreneur that needs to grow to do things like this?
So I'm just going to share with you is that there is the true character of us entrepreneurs is we think differently. And unfortunately, for years, I thought that I was just wired not correctly, and that people kept on saying to me, "Tom, why don't you just relax? Why don't you just stop? Why don't you just slow down and relax?" And us entrepreneurs, we get energy. This is the greatest game in the world. I don't watch sports anymore. I rather be in there doing it. And we have this need to solve big problems. And the more tools that you have and the more knowledge, it gives you the leverage to have bigger impact. Because I can promise you, as we talked earlier, 30, 40 years looking back, is the question is did I play big enough? And the one thing none of us ever want to look back and say, "Wow, I had a fine life. It was mediocre and I played small." Oh my God, it's your time. 2024 is your year. And just if you're thinking about it, get the knowledge and just go for it and have an amazing 2024.
Love it. Have a good rest of your day, everybody. Take
Awesome.
care. Thank you, Tom.